The more observant among you will notice that I'm not Christina Templeton. Christina, unfortunately, was stranded somewhere in St. Paul due to air traffic controllers' industrial dispute and lightning action. And she asked me would I deliver the paper, and I'm very pleased to do so. She sends her apologies, and apologies for me if I may not be as familiar with the material as I might otherwise have been. But thank you. I'll go ahead anyway. Thank you. The emotional consequences of the idealisation of the elderly married academic librarian male by the elderly unmarried academic librarian female, a study. Oh, just a note, there's no slides, only a couple of slides at the end, so you can close your eyes if you want. Purpose. The study described in this paper aims to identify the progress made in the efforts to model current models of emotion and emotional perception after the next generation of academic librarians in the UK and Finland. Abstract. This paper will explore the effect on the human heart of idealising an individual whom one has met once, kept in regular contact via email, which has become ever increasingly personal over the course of 1 year, and yearned to see again, only to be thwarted. Using unobtrusive, a mix of covert yet ethical observation methods and multiple open-ended interview scenarios, the emotional responses of the subject, hereafter called Emily, not her real name, were studied using the case study evaluation method. The principal findings indicated that Emily, due to her abnormally introspective personality and otherwise reserved nature, was below average, see Schneider 1974, at forming lasting friendships and had never partaken of a long-term, meaningful, loving relationship with another person. Emily was, therefore, lonely to an extent that the author of this paper had not encountered in previous studies. See Cooper et al. 1998. Covert methods for the observation of the subject, involving tape recordings, transcriptions of conversations, and interception and observation of emails, have, of course, ethical implications for the researcher. While the case study method can only attempt to capture a situation in time and not offer explicit solutions or interpretation of outcomes, one can observe that Emily's predicament is a universal one, even amongst those who, from a cursory explanation, may appear to be content, the Johansson-Elliott Contentment Rating Scale 1968, socially integrated and successful in their professional lives. What steps Emily took or might take to resolve her predicament is beyond the scope of this paper. While detailed and complex research into the human heart has been carried out before, see Austin, Bellow, Bronte, Bruckner, Fitzgerald, Kelman, McGahern, Moore, Trevor, Updike, Wharton, and others, few case studies on this specific subject can be found in the academic literature. It is envisaged that this paper may provide an impetus and or catalyst for further studies of this kind. Design methodology and approach. While an array of research methodologies was considered for this study, including positivist, epistemological and exclusively phenomenological approaches, it was decided that the case study was the most logical and coherent choice. Thomas, 2011, offers the following definition of a case study. Case studies are analyses of persons, events, decisions, periods, projects, policies, institutions, or other systems that are studied holistically by one or more methods. The case that is the subject of the inquiry will be an instance of a class of phenomenon that provides an analytical frame, an object, within which the study is conducted and which the case illuminates and explicates. The author proposed a typology for the case study following a definition whereby there is a detailed, intensive, and comprehensive, where possible, study of a unit, that is, a single discrete item, in this case being the person of Emily Davis. While a distinction is sometimes made between the theory-centred and illustrative study, Russell and Page, 1984, this paper will attempt to concentrate on disaggregating the emotional aspects for the traditional linear operational structures that concern comparative versus non-comparative versions of the form. While the case study does offer an array of permutational typologies of the trajectory of the study, will attempt to specifically focus on the complexities and relative magnitudes in possible seismic disturbances of the emotional response. Case description, history. Emily Davis is 62 years old. She's 5'6.5" tall and of slim build. On first encountering Emily, the observer may be acutely struck by the slightness of her build and mistakenly attribute this to a health disorder of some category. But after even cursory observation, it can be objectively observed that Emily's body shape is due to a combination of metabolism and genetic inheritance. For Emily is a conscientious, although obsessively healthy, eater. Emily seldom wears dresses, and in her professional life dresses in well-cut, slightly too expensive suits that she buys in upmarket department stores when she makes occasional trips into the centre of London from her small house in Hampstead. Shortly before this study commenced, Emily did present to her doctor complaining of a pain in her chest, located approximately where she believed her heart should be. She described the pain as 8 out of 10 on the Fitzgerald-Bachman 1987 Severity Index and continual as measured by the Frost-Sheehan 1994 Continuity Scale. On further questioning, it transpired that she also had classical non-trigger specific migraine headaches approximately every 3 months. She was also accident prone, having poor balance, knocking things over frequently, especially other people's coffee and small cafes, and falling over occasionally without ever significantly injuring herself. Emily did not have any previous history of presenting with psychiatric disorders. Originality and value. This is the first and only kind of study of its kind conducted thus far that evaluates the complex emotional entanglements of senior academic librarians in the UK and Finland. The findings will help academic librarians recognise and pinpoint the implications for complex cognitive dissonant outcomes when certain self-fulfilling destructive behaviours are repeatedly enacted. Keywords: librarians, emotion, loneliness, sadness, melancholia, depression, boredom, heartache, rejection, search for meaning, fear, and obsession. Subject of the study. Emily Davis is a highly distinguished and successful academic librarian. She is an internationally recognised expert on the design of information literacy system programmes for back to education adult learners and is frequent advisor and visitor to the Library of Congress in the US and the British Library in this capacity. She is also working on the development of new fields for complex multimedia cataloguing in the Bielenberg von Wolkenstein Kruger cataloguing system, 2007, and frequently represents the UK at various meetings of the EU and other international bodies in this regard. On the Mertzecker-Evans scale of habitualised loneliness, the standard measure for loneliness among academic librarians coming to retirement age, Emily scored such a high rating for loneliness that it was recommended that she retake the test. She agreed, but after resetting the test 2 days later, an analysis of the results indicated that Emily had actually scored 3.74 percentage points higher than in her previous test. Mertzecker defines loneliness as an affective state characterized by an intense consciousness of the self in relation to time and space and the perceived or real proximity and access to family, friends and colleagues, if one has access to any or all of these groupings. Friends are defined as people who maintain a detached, non-judgmental position when you make adverse decisions or mistakes in your personal or professional life which have negative implications at a later stage. Colleagues, on the other hand, are defined as people with whom you share professional interests but may cause you some higher levels of stress than the norm if isolated with them over the course of 2 or 3 days in artificially lit environments where even after-work entertainment and meals must be taken together. Emily's background. The cliché of being lonely in a crowd is a phenomenon which has received much coverage in the literature. See Spencer 76, Mooney 89 and Nicholson 2001. But this study is one of the few of its type to concentrate solely on a single lonely protagonist. Emily Davis's mother died when she was 11, her father when she was 22. Up to the age of 29, she lived with her sister, who eventually left the family home to get married. Emily and her sister have been estranged since the marriage, as Emily stated that she did not approve of her sister's then fiancé for an array of reasons that are beyond the scope of this study. That marriage did eventually break up. Emily, now 62, has lived on her own since her sister, who now lives in Sunderland, moved away. The reason why Emily has been alone or chosen to be alone for the subsequent accumulation of decades is also beyond the scope of this paper. Introduction. Excuse me. Living alone often has significant impacts on the formation of different learning outcomes, namely the competencies of cooperation, planning, decision-making, verbal skills, risk management, and more specific personal attributes like determination for achievement, patience, and willingness to accept criticism. Emily's chance meeting with Matti Litmanen, not his real name, highlights how quickly an individual can retrieve lost skills. See the Mannheim-Kendrick 1976 self-esteem rating evaluation scale. Assuming these skills have been learned by the individual at an earlier time, and that they are motivated by a desire to achieve a closeness with another human being in order to obtain a parity of respect. The meeting. The Helsinki meeting of the European Expert Group on the Future of Libraries lasted from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on day one, a Thursday in June, and finished at 1 p.m. on day two. Even without the complex armoury of observational tools that the case study method brought to this affair, it could be observed that Emily, the UK representative, was impressed, if not enthralled, by Matti Littmanen, the Finnish representative, from the beginning of the meeting. Matti Littmanen scored well in the Newman-Pitt-Clooney attractivity to the opposite or same-sex rating scale, Hunter 2006. To put this in context, he scored in the same percentile as Charlton Heston, Cary Grant, or in latter days Johnny Depp and George Clooney. He dressed impeccably in an inexpensive but not outrageously so grey suit, white shirt and silk maroon tie. Matti was scheduled to speak at the meeting and Emily was looking forward to it. The few times she had spoken at conferences herself, no matter how well prepared she was, and she was always exceptionally well prepared, had left her with an exceedingly upset stomach for at least 2 days after the conference. Matti spoke well in a presentation about ongoing conservation work in the Finnish National Library Archives, and even made a humorous comment, an event which was highly unusual at the meetings of the expert group, and was also unusual in its ability to make Emily laugh, as close observation of Emily revealed that she seldom laughed, even at the good films of Buster Keaton, the Marx Brothers, Laurel and Hardy, or the best of Charlie Chaplin. When Matti had finished speaking, he sat down beside her. The meeting in the Suurahoon Hotel in Helsinki wasn't that big, the meeting room, and when the speakers were finished, they simply sat back down in the small audience. He could have sat somewhere else. There were 11 empty chairs, but he sat beside Emily. After the first day, over dinner, on a cruise around the bay organised by the Finnish National Library, Emily found herself sitting beside Matti Littmanen again. He was married, but this did not disappoint Emily too much. Everybody she met was married now, and if they weren't, she assumed they were, and they just weren't wearing their rings. Not all men wore their wedding rings, but usually when she started talking to a man, or more likely in Emily's case, listening to a man, it wasn't long before he mentioned his wife, even if the subject hadn't seemed in the least related to whether he had a wife or not. Matti mentioned his wife twice in connection with the arts, but it was different with Matti. It seemed quite natural and relevant after all. Emily was delighted with the trip. There was no place she could think that she would rather be in the whole world than on a boat in Helsinki, being fed some strange seafood that she couldn't identify but tasted delicious, and having her wine glass refilled by a very efficient young man whenever it was even the slightest bit low. And Matti was beside her. A lady from the Finnish Department of Education had sat beside them for a while, talking about the newly released figures from the department, showing the uptake in third-level education for disadvantaged socio-economic groups in Finland. Emily hoped she would go off and board the others at the next table, and there must have been something hostile in Emily's body language, because she soon did. For a moment, Emily wondered what disadvantaged Finnish people looked like. She had previously thought that all Finns were fluent in at least three languages and had perfect skin and dress sense, but this obviously was not the case. Emily told Matti that the islands around Helsinki reminded her of the style of some painter. She said that she thought the islands looked very lonely. Matti had agreed with her and said that he knew what she meant, although he couldn't think of the name of the artist either. He said his wife was a painter. Oils, he said, with a grave expression, and that she had quite a reputation in Finland, but her name didn't mean anything to Emily. Other men were dull, but Matti wasn't, and she felt as content as she had ever felt. The wine was helping too. It tasted almost creamy, and she made a note to herself that she should slow down. It wouldn't do to get drunk. It just wouldn't do. It can be observed that she spoke in a 19-to-81% ratio to Matti at the dinner. She could see the harbour now, and she didn't want the meal to be over. The idea of going back to her hotel and reading another Susan Hill or Anita Bruckner novel was just too dull. But one of the group suggested that they go to a bar, that it was too early to go home. Matti said he knew a place near the hotel. Emily was pleased, and this was out of character for Emily, to be going to a bar, to want to go to a bar after 10 o'clock in the evening with a group of strangers. But she wanted to talk some more with Matti, or at the very least be in his company. It was a 15-minute, 23-second walk from the harbour to the hotel and bar up near the railway station. Matti walked a little ahead of her and spoke with others from the group. She was a little disappointed but understood. He was the host after all. She thought she would like to live in Helsinki. A brass band played on the bandstand in the park and she smiled as she passed by. The bar was quite full. Approximately 74% of the comfortable seating was taken, but there were still plenty of spaces for the majority of the European Expert Group on the Future of Academic Libraries. The Estonian and Swedish representatives had gone back to the hotel, the former with a headache and the latter pleading tiredness. There was a live soccer match on the large screen televisions in the bar. Italy were playing against Holland. It was the European Championships. Matty explained to Emily. Most of the librarians became engaged with the match. Holland scored and somebody in the pub shouted approval. Matty sat at a table with his back to the television and spoke to Emily. They spoke mainly about library work and laughed together a little at the dullness of library meetings. Emily wanted to stay. She wanted to talk to Matty all night, but she knew that that was not possible. Even if he hadn't been married, Emily had had too much wine. She knew she wouldn't be sick yet, but if she had another, she might be, and she couldn't bear to be sick. She was also afraid if she had another drink that she might get the hiccups. She often got the hiccups when she had too much to drink, and that would just be too humiliating, especially in front of Matty, although she knew he would be an absolute gentleman about it. "I'd better go," she said. "I'd better be fresh in the morning." "So soon," Matty said. "Must you? Just one more drink." He appeared to be genuinely disappointed. "No, I think I've had enough. Good night. See you tomorrow." It had been a wonderful feeling, a handsome man asking her to stay for another drink. It took some time for Emily to remember when she had last felt this peculiar intensity of emotion. In her 20s, there had been a young man named Alfred Butler, and he had liked her. She had met him at library school. They had gone to the cinema together once, something with Elizabeth Taylor. She couldn't remember what. But as soon as he got his qualification, he had gone to Canada, and she had never heard from him again. Emily wasn't aware of the cold as she walked, and she was always sensitive to the cold. She slept heavily for 2 hours, awoke restless, and then went to sleep again before her alarm went off at 8 for the second day of the meeting. That morning, a representative from Helsinki University spoke about new advances in cataloguing software. Another speaker from Germany gave a pompous presentation entitled Cloud Computing, The View from the Stars. Emily did not appear to be listening, and she took no notes. This was peculiar, as she had a specific interest in the future of cloud computing and had hoped at one stage to submit an article to the Journal of Academic Librarianship on the subject. She found herself beside Matty again at lunch, and he was as charming, as kind as he had been the evening before. When he heard that her plane was not leaving until the following morning, there had been no convenient flight to London that evening, he offered to show her around the city for the afternoon. He made it clear that he'd have to leave her at 6. After the meeting, Matty suggested that they see the Olympic Stadium, and after that the National Gallery, which he was delighted to say was hosting an exhibition by one of the most well-known and critically acclaimed Finnish artists, Pekka Halonen. It seemed a rather long walk to the stadium, and while the rain threatened, it did not fall. Matty was rather irate when they could not gain access to the stadium and tower due to a private function. They did, however, go to the museum and shop, where Matty told Emily about the great Finnish distance runner Paavo Nurmi, who had won 9 gold and 3 silver medals in 3 Olympic Games from 1920 to 28. Emily had never been interested in athletics or sports of any type. She'd always thought that any activity where you're expected to shower afterwards was somehow indelicate. But Emily bought a black and white photograph of Nurmi winning a race. She said to Matty that he looked too frail to be able to win so many gold medals. Matty didn't understand the word frail. Emily explained it to him. Emily appeared tired in the National Gallery. Matty asked her if she wanted to sit down, but she said she was happy to continue. There were many, many works of varying quality by Pekka Halonen. She told Matty that she liked the winter landscapes. He said casually that there was something of winter about her. She did not respond to this, but suggested that they leave. She would remember his phrase later on, something of winter. At the time, she was strangely flattered. She had equated it with beauty, but much later, on reflection, she assumed he had meant cold and forbidding and joyless. The hotel was very close to the gallery, and Matty insisted he walk her back. They had a drink at the hotel bar. It was in the shape of a crescent and very elegant. There was nobody else there. She wished Matty could have stayed for the whole evening. She might have got the hiccups, but he might have got a little drunk too. There was a big Art Deco clock on the wall behind the bar. At 6 o'clock, Matty said that he had to leave. He stood up and leaned over to her and hugged her. She stood too. Nobody had hugged her in such a long time. "I'll email if I have any library problems that I think you can help me with," she said. "Email even if you don't have any problems." He walked out through the revolving doors then. She watched him leave until she couldn't see him anymore. It started to rain. The email. The European Expert Group on the Future of Academic Libraries is being held in Lisbon this year. Matty Litmanen will not be attending. He emailed Emily to say he was taking early retirement, but he had enjoyed their meeting very much. When Emily read the message, it would appear that it triggered a reactive depression response, although the methodology of this study cannot categorically confirm that the email caused the depression, and an exact measure of the severity of the depression is outside the scope of this study. Outcomes. Emily's immediate reaction after Matty's message was to contact the Lisbon meeting organisers, explaining that regretfully, due to unforeseen circumstances, she would be unable to attend. The meeting organisers responded with an email saying that unfortunately the cancellation deadline had passed and she would still be liable for the full fee. Emily did not reply. It can be empirically observed that Emily sometimes does not go to her office in the library, and she spends much time listening to the works of Mahler or Stravinsky, and sometimes Billie Holiday, on the couch in the main room of her small house in Hampstead. She has increased her intake of alcohol, white wine specifically, by 64% since the incident. She does not clean her teeth every evening before bed, and she is sometimes slightly late for the library when she does go, whereas previous to the incident, she was always earlier on time. She is, however, diligent about filling her timesheet and works up the missed hours, morning hours and midweek evenings, except in summer, when she likes to go for long walks on the heath. Conclusions and recommendations. The results show that social interactions with artificially disambiguated and isolated like-minded peers for the duration of the meeting of the expert group enabled Emily to develop and strengthen otherwise neglected elements of her character through specific active enterprises, such as walking to the Olympic Stadium and making a visit to the Finnish National Gallery. Emily appeared to realise through her verbal interaction with Matty that not only could she find another person interesting and likeable, while she had come to regard herself as an academic bore with an obsessive interest in old Middle English and commensurate historical texts, but certain parties could situate the same or similar attributes in her. The subject was not only able to put theory into practice, but also increase her comprehensiveness of understanding through practical experience. Emily's demonstration of emotion, evidenced by her crying response to the closing scene of the film It's a Wonderful Life, Capra 1955, the evening after Matty's email, implies that individual knowledge, skills and attributes take on meaning in accordance with the particular experience of practice. There had been no demonstrable overtly emotional response previously by Emily to skilled manipulative media. She had not cried at The Elephant Man, E.T. or Au revoir les enfants, and it can be inferred by observation that living experience of practice cannot be ignored in developing an individual's competence. Gaining experience is more important than having a net perceptual deficit in the context of the entirety of the relatively constricted span of a lived life, notwithstanding the dramatic improvement in life expectancy and expected exponential growth in this area forthcoming. While this study cannot conclusively state that the fact of Matty's non-attendance at the meeting in Lisbon caused Emily's emotional response to It's a Wonderful Life, it is highly likely that it was a significant factor. Emily continues to function at a high level in her professional life, but scores less well in her personal life. Christina just wanted me to run through the references with you quickly. We have Goodbye Mark, Hello Sam, Cataloguing for the New Millennium, It's a Wonderful Life, Trust, Mistrust in the Human Condition, a Longitudinal Study, and Sticks and Stones Can Break Your Heart, the Psychological Science Quarterly. There's Heartache, Heartbreak and Romantic Yearning, a Continuity Scale, the Newman Pitt Clooney Attractivity, the Opposite or Same Sex Rating Scale, and that's from Psychology, Behaviour and Research Methods. The last one there, I'm not okay, you're okay, a self-esteem rating evaluation. And then we have some from the Journal of Missouri and Educational Psychologist. And the last one there, loneliness in the context of developmental research. And the last reference, case studies, lonely in a crowd from atavistic deconstructionist modalities. And that's it. Thank you very much for listening. I understand to have to sit there for half an hour and listen to, or however long it took, it's difficult to listen without slides. And thank you very, very much for listening. Thank you.
I can't quite believe I'm going to say it, but does anybody have any questions for Steve?
Emily's or Matthew's in the audience, but otherwise, I forgot to mention that he's a librarian and a playwright. So thank you. It's quite unusual. Was that somebody shouting a question?
No? Yeah, can we have her address?
Send me your email. I'll get it to you.
Is there any final questions, say for Ian? Anything else cropped up?